Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Marvin Garin, Pamela Chaddock, and Andre Redatis. Hi, you guys.
Well, hi. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy
Good
New
to be
Year.
Back.
Yeah.
Hi,
it
folks.
Is. I've missed you so much. I've missed it so much. Gosh. It was a long break, longer than normal for me. So it's really good to be back.
And, well, it was interesting. There's a lot going on. I mean, you traveled and, you know, I guess you're going to share some sort of some special events. And then we had the Christmas holiday. So it was an interesting time, a little bit of a break time.
Yeah. Well, and it always is, right? But this is the first time that I have ever been out of Colorado for Christmas, away from home.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there's not many things. that's high holy times for me, my family, always. And I think most people, you know, who celebrate Christmas would say that. It's a real special family time. And but my youngest daughter, Mei Lee, married a man from southern India in the area of Chennai. His name is Shankar Lalita Sridhar. And she met him at CU. She didn't go to CU, but he was attending CU, finishing his education, and that's when they met him. And they have been joined at the hip ever since. And so they got married officially in 2022, but then they had two more celebrations of marriage, one for their friends and family members in America and in Colorado, and then another for their friends and family members in India. And Shankar's parents are devout Hindus. And so we had the most amazing experience of a Hindu wedding. And it was absolutely thrilling to be there. And we left on the 16th of December. Yeah. And it was just, I say some words have no meaning, but this was a meaning that has no word.
Mm.
And my son-in-law knows how, you know, religious I am. And so, and his mother is deeply religious as well. And so we hit it off completely, me and Lalitha, his mom. And we went to several temples. And it was in an ashram that Marvin and Pam, you probably recognize, the name Vivekananda.
Oh, yeah.
It was his ashram. And he was the one that went to the parliament in 1893 and blew everybody away.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that was so, I you know, I can't tell you what a full circle experience that was for me to go to his ashram and to know that the Indians celebrate the fact that he came to the West. That's a big deal to them. And they celebrate the fact that he addressed the parliament as brothers and sisters, not ladies and gentlemen. Shankar's dad made it a point to tell me that. He addressed that assembly as brothers and sisters, not ladies and gentlemen. And to be at his ashram and to be able to buy books, I bought 4 books on him while there at their bookstore, and it was just a real full circle experience for me, and I told the kids that.
Oh,
I got choked up. But, yeah, it was really, really special.
Oh,
and, of course, the way
well, you know, that's,
so many.
God. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, Paula. I mean, the words you were using and the whole experience you were just describing to us, the sense of full circle and sisters and brothers, and, I mean, and I experienced this in India as well and in my travels, and it comes from being steeped in this amazing Urantra book, Revelation. You really have a living experience, a living sense of how really deepened by our diversity, we have this experience of spiritual family, you know, that we're all part of this circle that is all-encompassing, and we are really sisters and brothers, and that's that to me is one of the reasons. And it sounds like this family celebration was a really deep experience for you of that spiritual family relationship, and that's what happened at the parliament. I think it was one of the earliest experiences that a number of religionists had of a phenomenon that has been developing over the last 120, 150 years, and that is really the globalization of our spiritual family. It's not just a theory anymore. We're beginning to experience it, you know, in our in our bones, in a sense. And when you go to have an experience like that wedding and you celebrate together the joining of those two people in marriage, and you celebrate together from diverse cultures, and this happens, you know, Paula, at the parliaments as well. It's such a powerful experience of our affinity with each other under God. You know, it's just it's an amazing experience when it happens.
And of course, they know because I'm so interested in. I'm such an interested religionist, you know. I'm so interested in them that they were more than willing to tell me all about their faith and what they believe, and they told me about Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and the three main deities, and I said, oh, that's like the Trinity, and they looked at me really funny, like, oh, yeah, I guess it is, you know, so it was just an interesting, wonderful sharing of, you know, ideas and love of humanity. And you know, their faith is so ancient, and being in Tamil Nadu, southern India. I'll just say it easy. That's their language. Tamil is one of the oldest languages on the planet, if not the oldest. And their culture is so ancient. And to celebrate marriage with them, it's just unsurpassed as an experience, a joining of not only of two families, which every marriage is, but a joining of two cultures, two very different cultures, but yet very much the same, you know? marriage is so highly revered there, so celebrated, so cherished, so precious and sacred to them. It was really, really beautiful to be there for that and see that and share that with my May, who looked like an Asian princess. Oh, my God. By the time they got done dressing her up, she looked like she stepped right out of the pages of an Arabian Nights story. It was pretty special.
That was a great picture. My heart is full.
Yeah, I did. I shared that picture with you guys, and I did share them on Facebook. Tamil Nadu, thank you. Thank you, Andre. I want to tell you guys, it was quite a transformation. And I, of course, they were saying, oh, you know, Paul wants to go to the ashram of Vivekananda. And I'm like, who? Who's this? Vivekananda. You mean Vivekananda? But they don't say it that way. they call him Vivekananda. And so it took me a while to, you know, understand. They pronounce these things that we say, they say quite differently. But it was really an amazing learning experience for me, one that I will remember for eternity. So, yeah. My heart is full.
I remember when I was there really feeling the truth. And so something it says somewhere in the Arantxa book about how you become like what you worship. Remember that?
Mm.
I forget where that comes up. Mm-hmm. So we become like whatever we worship. Right? And
Carol,
it says worship is a transforming experience that transforms a person to become like the object of worship. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So in Kerala, where Vipin's from, they all worship Krishna. And you should really feel it in the people there because they've taken on the character of Krishna in some, I don't know, conscious, unconscious way. I don't know, but it's very sweet. I mean, Krishna, I don't know, of all their deities, maybe the closest to Jesus in a way.
Yeah.
In character.
I agree.
I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
He was an incarnation too, an incarnation sent from the Creator, and I pointed that out as well. I said how Christ-like that is, how Jesus-like that is, and they were all, you know, open to that, those comparisons.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just remember feeling safe everywhere. Everyone's kind.
Yeah. Yeah, me too, sir.
You know, it's been an interesting experience for me to have experienced, I was going to go one place, but another thought sort of entered in. You know, I spent 5 months in India when I was in my 20s. I was in college.
Wow.
And, yeah, I went to a college that had centers in different parts of the world. It was called the Friends World College. Quakers originated it. I don't even know if it still exists. But I was in India, and their campus was in Bangalore. And what really, one of my takeaways from being in India for that five-month period, which was an amazing experience, and one of the things I experienced was I happened upon a local wedding. And so I know the sense of festivities. They do it in a way that's different from us. They process down through the streets, and all the neighbors come out, and everyone's cheering, and it's just like it's like a community festival. It's really amazing,
right?
And but what's so interesting for me is I'm thinking of three different locations here in the United States, that time in India, and one of our two daughters, married a Muslim fellow, and as a result of that, we have in-laws. You know, my son-in-law's parents and very large family are from Algeria, and Francois and I have gone to Algeria for weeks at a time and hung out with their family in a Muslim culture. And it's just so interesting to see the expressions of the religious life in these different cultures. It's the same religious life. It's the same deity that's living in each of these different cultures, but the culture, the cultural expressions like Krishna or Muhammad or Allah or Christ, or, you know, it's like there are all these different cultural embodiments of the divine into those cultures. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, every one of those religions has its poor aspects where historically there have been horrendous things happen in every one of the major religions. But when you put that aside and you look at the beauty and the depth of what it does in people's lives in these different cultures and taking shape in such different ways, expressing. I remember one of my treasured memories, we were in Algiers. And we were going to travel to Oran, which is the second largest city in Algeria, to be with Yassine's family. And we were in a little hostel in Algiers. And I remember waking up really early at like 4 or 5 in the morning with a sunrise, because the call to worship, you know, 5 times a day was going out. And all over the city, the muezzins, I'm not pronouncing it probably, the people who the in Islam the they put it out over loudspeakers, and over the entire city the call to worship goes out to all believers to come to the into the presence of God and recognize and worship God, and so the city is all, everything comes to a halt, the whole city, and everyone stops and engages in that ritual of recognition of God's presence. And it was just an amazing experience to see a whole city come to a standstill and worship God. And they do that 5 times a day with a call to worship. Mm. It's from mosques all over the city. This call, you can hear it all over the city, mm-hmm. and everyone mm-hmm. stops. It's such an interesting experience. And so, you know, it's just, I think one of the treasures of being on this planet is these incredibly varied cultural expressions of coming to the divine, you know. And we just experienced Christmas, and I mean, that's an incredible experience of coming close into the presence of Jesus and our Father, and so it's just it's amazing to be alive on this world, to see these things, you know. It really is.
I couldn't agree more. As scary as this world can be, it's also remarkable and beautiful, rich. You know, I think we could alleviate a lot of problems religiously and religious misunderstandings if we would just approach other religions with respect for the reverence that they feel, you know, and some kind of sympathetic understanding of how some certain actions on our part can seem very irreverent to them and very disrespectful. We need to tune into that, I think, a little bit, and be more responsible as world citizens. Part of the problem in the world that we live in right now is the fact that we're all interconnected now. And some things that one religionist might find deeply offensive is all over the internet, you know, and you can see why they think maybe we're crazy. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
We
have to become world citizens, not that we have to all be Muslims or we all have to all be Hindus or we have to all be Christians or we have to all be anything. We just have to all be respectful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the contrast in the news media in our interconnected world and the internet, the news media tends to take those things that happen that are most negative and horrendous because they're sensational, you know, and they blast them out to us, and that's what we get preoccupied with. So unfortunately for many people in all parts of the world, what they hear about other religions is some of the worst, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But you've experienced this, Paula. When you go and actually live with people who you're connected to via family, and you live in a different culture with a different religion, and you see the heart of the people and how they love and how their culture expresses their love of God differently. Mm. There's nothing negative about it. It's filled with a tremendous and amazing beauty. as to how varied those expressions are. They're so different culturally. And yet
but still
it's
so
the same,
precious.
Yeah, it's the same love for God that these people have, you know.
The same reverence.
So,
right.
And that's really what's going on in all, most places, not the negative stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Pam, were you going to say something?
I was going to say there's as many versions of religion as there are individuals. So it's always
true.
It's a one-on-one experience at every moment.
Yeah, there's a quote from the Urantia book about how intolerance is the mask of insecurity, right? When people are intolerant of other people's religions, they're actually being insecure of their own. You remember that quote, you guys? Am I saying it right? Let me see if I can find it. It's such a great one.
You have the gist of it,
Yeah.
But anyway, well, we are in the middle of, or at the end, I should say, at the end of our study of the paper 7, The Eternal Son. And, you know, maybe, Andre, what happened? You guys couldn't get the show to go on. What was the problem there?
Oh, yes. After I looked under the hood, I found the squirrels, and they had run off with the carburetor. That's definitely what was happening.
You found the squirrels.
No question about it.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
I found that quote, by the way. Go ahead.
Yeah, ticked off. It just it did not let us get on whatsoever, and so the next week we were able to test it correctly, but then two were missing and one was sick, and so I decided that the Andre and Pam show did not need to go on. That would have been fun, though.
It would have been
anyway.
Fun.
That would have been an experiment.
Well,
yes, it would have.
You know, as our original host used to say, Andre Traversa used to say, well, it's live radio, folks. That's what you said.
Yeah,
this is live radio. And he really appreciated it. He really appreciated the possibilities inherent in live radio, that things can go wrong. And so it never bothered him. But, it's unscripted and it's live. And he loved that about it. And I do, too. I've come to really appreciate it. So, but here's the quote I was referring to. And this, of course, is from the master himself. And it's from paper 146. And he says, the midwayers tell us the apostles were a bit disconcerted by the open manner of Jesus' assent to many of the Greeks' propositions. They were listening to a Greek philosopher. But Jesus afterward privately said to them, "My children, marvel not that I was tolerant of the Greeks' philosophy. True and genuine inward certainty does not in the least fear outward analysis, nor does truth resent honest criticism. You should never forget that intolerance is the mask covering up the entertainment of secret doubts as to the trueness of one's belief. No man is at any time disturbed by his neighbor's attitude when he has perfect confidence in the truth of that which he wholeheartedly believes. Courage is the confidence of thoroughgoing honesty about those things which one professes to believe. Sincere men are unafraid of the critical examination of their true convictions and noble ideals."
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's an attitude.
Beautiful.
An attitude to take into the world with you, right?
Right.
Well, you know, Paula,
that's 146.32 for those that are looking for it, and it's posted in the chat.
Thanks, Andre. Thank you. 146.32.
You know, And that, for me, hooks up with an experience, and I know many of us have had it at the parliaments. And this, it's this interesting experience of when I encounter other people's religions, there's nothing threatening about it. There, I can hold my own sense of God and approach to God and the sanctity of my own spiritual life and my own tradition. And when I see how it expresses in other people's lives, it's a joy. It's a joy to see the diversity of how it expresses in people's lives. There's nothing threatening about it at all. You know, it's actually satisfying.
Yeah, I'm immediately drawn to see what similarities I
sense.
Me too. And you know, acknowledge the similarities. Yeah.
Well, and actually enjoy and celebrate the diversity. It's like it's a kick.
Of course.
To see how different. Yeah, it's just really fun. You know. Yeah.
Right. Often it's just semantics. We're believing the same great truths. We just have a different way of looking at it. It's like the blind man and the elephant, right? We're all groping for the truth, seeing it in a different way. But we all hold a piece.
Yeah.
So, Well, that thanks
sounds
for
like
that great interface. What?
Sounds
what,
like you're
Jack?
Talking about people who might describe as religionists in maybe contrast to just sort of belonging to a church or having a religion, or I don't know, but a religionist, like somebody who enjoys it, takes it seriously, can talk about it,
right?
Can share
the beauty of it,
enter into conversation with other religionists. Wish there was more of that, just available, you know, where people are just like interested in God, so they talk about it. Or, you know what I mean? I mean, where there's a enthusiast. Enthusiast, that's a better word for me. A religion enthusiast.
You know, that hooks up, Chuck, that hooks up with a really interesting passage. I think it's toward the end of the book, and I don't have it easily at hand. But it's the one where they say that most modern Christians, and I think it's true of most modern religionists in general, are unwitting secularists,
right?
Which is such an interesting statement, and I think what they're saying is exactly what you're referring to, Chuck. Is most people in their religious involvement deal with it in a pretty superficial and cultural way. They go, they participate as part of their participation in the culture, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
What they're saying is they don't have a really living and pervasive engagement, a relationship with God that fills their days day in and day out. It's a box you check and then you're done with it. It's pretty superficial. And so I like what you're saying is, you know, it's almost like a real religionist is someone who goes much deeper than the cultural expression and really is engaged spiritually with God in a more pervasive way.
Enthusiastic about God.
Yeah.
Which is kind of different from being enthusiastic about your church or whatever.
Well, what you're talking about is one of the things I really love about hanging out with the Progressive Emergents is they are true religionists, and they love. I mean, you know, they love theological exchange. And, I mean, they're also very, you know, loving and giving and, you know, active in the world. But the conversations they get into are just delightful. And I love participating with them, you know, on their broadcasts and in the chat room and all of that, because there's a lot of activity going on in there. And, you know, diving deep into concepts, and it's just very enjoyable for me. I'm enjoying that a lot. So, there are definite religionists out there.
Good to hear.
And especially within coming out of the Christian church, which has tended to be very fundamental them versus us. Even, you know, it's like the midwares say sect divided. And in almost in a pathetic way, you know, a pathetic division. that a house divided cannot stand. I think they even make that parallel. And what's beautiful about the emergence is they're getting over that, and they're saying, "Oh yeah, you're Methodist. Okay, great. You know, you're Protestant. Okay, come on, let's join in. You know, we're all Christians. We all have the same teachings. Let's see what we have in common."
Well, I have a question for you, Pam. And my sense is, to the extent, and you've had much more interaction with emerging Christians than I have, but I've had some, and I've always enjoyed it immensely. They really are thinking and creative religionists, and they take their Christianity seriously. But my sense is that they also have a pretty healthy respect for the interfaith arena and other people's religions. They don't castigate other people's religions. They respect it. Is that your sense as well?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this last week, they were talking about Christology in honor of Advent, because they are some of them are rather liturgical and they follow the calendar. And there were different levels of Jesus that they were exploring, how people are approaching Jesus, you know, whether he's a moral teacher, you know, and then they go to the more complex version of the Trinitarian involvement and all of that. And one of the questions that came up towards the end is some of the chat room was concerned that Christianity is too self-centered about Jesus. And so that, in other words, the conversation about being beyond Jesusonian came up in the conversation. So it was very rich. It was very rich to have the people on the chat board be concerned about that, as well as the leaders of this conversation. So yes, definitely. Thank you for bringing that up, Marvin, because it was very evident in that 2-hour discussion. It was a great discussion. But,
well, you know, that's interesting, Pam, because to me there's something I think we have in common with emergent Christians, and actually with deeper and more sophisticated religionists in every tradition, in the Urantia movement. And my experience is people who really deeply understand what this revelation is saying are like what we were saying, what Chuck was saying, or I forget who was saying. No one as a Urantia book reader is threatened by someone who holds their religion strongly in a different tradition. It's like, that's perfectly okay. I don't have to convert you or convince you of my way of thinking. I can enjoy and respect your way of approaching God. And I think for you B readers, that's really rooted in the reality that after this life is done and we go to the mansion world, we're all going to be in a much higher and reality where we have a huge amount, to learn. Anyways,
yes,
so
we're all going to be baffled. We'll be baffled together. Yes,
exactly.
Overwhelmed.
It's like that great old joke about, you know, Saint Peter telling a visitor to heaven, when he asked, "Who are they over there?" And Saint Peter said, "Oh, they're Christians. They think they're the only ones here." we keep them over there while they get used to the fact that they're not the only ones here.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of what I like about the Urantia book. The conception is no one who really reads the Urantia book is under the misimpression that the only people there are going to be Urantia book readers. That's absurd.
Yeah, right. That's right. For sure.
What a great interfaith conversation, you guys. I always love that.
Happy, today is Epiphany. Happy Epiphany, everyone.
Oh. Happy Epiphany.
Yes, happy Epiphany to you.
Yeah. What a great thing to celebrate.
It was 12th night last night, and here we are on the Epiphany.
Yay.
Yes.
Well, let's have an epiphany, shall we?
All right. Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have some real epiphanies as we study these last two sections of paper 7, Relation of the Eternal Son to the Universe.
Yes.
So we're all paradise sons of God? Is that where we are?
I believe so. Is that right, Andre? Paper 7,
yes.
Section 6,
we are
six,
at
right?
The paradise sons of God, yeah.
Number 6.
Number 6.
Cool.
Okay, who would like to read that one?
I would.
I'd be glad to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead, Marvin.
You take one, Marvin, and then Andre, you can do one. The next one.
Good.
Since we're going to try to do two today.
Yeah,
I'll do the second one. Go ahead, Marvin.
All right, yeah, they're fairly short. So we're in paper 7, sections 6 and 7, and section 6 is the Paradise Sons of God, and 7 is the Supreme Revelation of the Father. Oh, they sound pretty juicy. Okay, Paradise Sons of God. The lack of a knowledge of the multiple sons of God is a source of great confusion on Urantia.
Mm.
Amen to that.
Mm.
And this ignorance persists in the face of such statements as the record of a conclave of these divine personalities. When the sons of God proclaimed joy and all of the morning stars sang together. Every millennium of sector standard time, the various orders of the divine sons foregather for their periodic conclaves. The eternal, so I guess that statement would say this ignorance persists in the face of such statements. That must be a statement in the scripture about the with sons of God. So they, yeah, got it. The eternal son is the personal source of the adorable attributes of mercy and service, which so abundantly characterize all orders of the descending sons of God as they function throughout creation. All the divine nature, if not all the infinity of attributes, the eternal Son unfailing transmits to the paradise sons who go out from the eternal isle to reveal his divine character to the universe of universes. I'm going to read that sentence again. All the divine nature, if not all the infinity of attributes, the eternal Son unfailingly transmits to the paradise sons who go out from the eternal isle to reveal his divine character to the universe of universes. The original and eternal Son is the offspring person of the first completed and infinite thought of the universal Father. That's interesting that they put first in parentheses, on quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
Every time the universal Father and the eternal Son jointly project a new, original, identical, unique, and absolute personal thought, that very instant, this creative idea is perfectly and finally personalized in the being and personality of a new and original Creator Son.
Mm.
In spirit nature, divine wisdom, and coordinate creative power, these Creator Sons are potentially equal with God the Father and God the Son. Interesting, they use the word potentially.
Hmm.
The Creator Sons go out from paradise into the universes of time, and with the cooperation of the controlling and creative agencies of the third source and center, complete the organization of local universes of progressive evolution. These sons are not attached to, nor are they concerned with, the central and universe controls of matter, mind, and spirit. Hence, they are limited in their creative acts by the pre-existence, priority, and primacy of the first source and center and his coordinate absolutes. These sons are able to administer only that which they bring into existence. Absolute administration is inherent in priority of existence and is inseparable from eternity of presence. The Father remains primal in the universes. Much as the Creator Sons are personalized by the Father and the Son, so are the Magisterial Sons personalized by the Son and the Spirit. These are the sons who, in the experiences of creature incarnation, earn the right to serve as the judges of survival in the creations of time and space. The Father, Son, and Spirit also unite to personalize the versatile Trinity Teacher Sons, who range the grand universe as the supernal teachers of all personalities, human and divine. And there are numerous other orders of paradise sonship that have not been brought to the attention of Urantia mortals. Between the original Mother Son and these hosts of paradise sons scattered throughout all creation, there is a direct and exclusive channel of communication, a channel whose function is inherent in the quality of spiritual kinship, which unites them in bonds of near absolute spiritual association. This inter-sonship circuit, what an interesting term, this inter-sonship circuit is entirely different from the universal circuit of spirit gravity, which also centers in the person of the second source and center. All sons of God who take origin in the persons of the paradise deities are in direct and constant communication with the eternal Mother Son. And such communication is instantaneous. It is independent of time, though sometimes conditioned by space. The Eternal Son not only has at all times perfect knowledge concerning the status, thoughts, and manifold activities of all orders of paradise sonship, but he also has perfection of knowledge at all times regarding everything of spiritual value which exists in the hearts of all creatures in the primary central creation of eternity and the secondary time creations of the coordinate Creator Sons.
Well, thank you, Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing section that is.
It really is amazing, yeah. I got a quick sort of detailed question. That second to last paragraph, when they use the word inter-sonship, is that a unique word? I've never seen that anywhere else.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah,
I've never seen that in the English language anywhere else. That's like a unique one, I think.
Yeah, it's there.
Probably used only once in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes up as being misspelled if you type it into a search engine.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, wow.
But it's a good neologism for indicating, you know, inter is between. Well, go ahead, Pam. Sorry.
I was going to say, I just typed it into Google, and it says, do you mean internship? And I went, no.
Right.
I typed intersonship, and the first thing that comes up is Truth Book, Relation of the Eternal Son to the Universe.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a coined word, in other words. Yeah,
it's a new word,
to yeah. Right.
It really communicates very clearly, though, you know. There's no ambiguity there in the context.
Yeah.
And it's
what Kristen
Michaels used to say was a once word, which she believed, she believed was something to get our attention and to somehow allow us to locate a little bit easier and to I don't know what she would say about it, but almost like to create some buzz. And when you think about this, it did with Marvin this morning, inter-sonship, the idea that here we have a sonship circuit that is between all divine sons and the original mother son. That's really what all that inter-sonship circuit means. But it's interesting because there's indication that, you know, the eternal son is spiritually cognizant and in touch with all of his creature creation. So the question is, why the special circuit?
Well, it's a special set of relationships, I think.
Yeah.
It's like the hotline.
The hotline.
You know? Yeah, it's the hotline. Direct answer.
You mean like the bat phone?
Yeah.
I remember the bat phone. Yeah.
Yeah.
The red phone.
I'm getting a little bit of feedback, too, just so you guys know. So, but I thought you might be interested. We mentioned, Marvin mentioned the quote, when the sons of God proclaimed joy and all the morning stars sang together, in quotations, in that section. We live in an age where we can drop that into a search engine, and guess what comes up? Job 38:7. And it says, Jehovah claims that the cornerstone of the earth was laid when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The sons of God in this context refer to angels. The verse implies that the morning stars were living beings. The event referred to in the verse is the creation of a new world, which was the event that was fitted to honor God.
Yeah.
You know, that's
and
one of the most beautiful things.
And of course, if you ask
things.
Christians, they don't really know
don't
what
really
that refers
know.
To. Yeah.
Right. You know, I encountered this. Go ahead, Andre, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, just reading Genesis, I had the same issue when I was a young person and I read Genesis, and it gave you the account of God toiling in the soil to create Adam and Eve. And then it kind of shifts and says, let us make men and women in our image.
Yeah. Our.
And I remember thinking, who's us? Who are they talking about? I thought God was the only one. You know, and we set men and women forth upon the earth. Okay, who's we? You know, and that was my first. Well, I don't get it. You know, in the Bible, I just don't get it. What? Who are they talking about? And if you ask a learned scholar of the Bible, you're right. They won't be able to answer. They'll you know, they'll try, but it's not satisfying because it's it doesn't make sense. And
you mean
the Arantia. Go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, are you talking about the we part?
Well, right.
Who
yeah.
is we?
You know, first it says,
that
God toiled in the soil to make Adam and Eve. Okay, so it's God and Adam and Eve. But then it says, let us. Okay, so who's us?
Well, that's the big switch between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
Right.
They're very different. They're like two different stories.
Yeah.
And in the first one, in Genesis 1, it's more like, you know, Michael and the mother sphere. It's like we, you know, it doesn't have all the strangeness that's in Genesis 2. It's really interesting, I think.
That was the first disconnect for me.
Well, you know,
what's
interesting to me is that this brings up a very central and fundamental theological issue. And that is, and the Arantia book treats it, I think, with much greater sophistication than anything else I've ever seen. And that is the idea of deity having not only three modes of function in the persons of the Trinity, the original Trinity, but multiple modes of function at varying levels of deity function.
A good example
being these paradise sons of God, the creator sons and the magisterial sons and others who are created as extensions of God's own nature at lower and lower levels to function in the different local sectors of the universes of time and space. So you have a concept, not only do you have the creator, the original creator father of the eternal mother son, who are both co-creators of the infinite spirit, all of whom are in some sense the same deity expressing in different ways and functioning in different modalities. But you also have the creator sons who are also the same, in a certain essential sense, deity, just as much as the Trinity are deity, but they're downstepped in their manifestation and in their function.
Yeah.
And they serve the same purpose in a local creation that the Trinity serves in relationship to the central universe. So that's a much more sophisticated understanding of the nature of deity and its multiple expressions and manifestations than I think exists in any other religion. And you see, Muslim theology has real problems with even the idea of Trinity. How can you have a single God manifesting in different ways? And yet the Orange Book is saying, wait a sec, that's just the beginning. functions in ways you can't even imagine at all different kinds of levels.
Right. You know, we wouldn't even know about God if he wasn't able to trinitize. That's how he expresses
Isn't
reality.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you had mentioned
it's a social God.
It is a
God that has relationships.
Yes.
That's the thing about the Trinity.
Yeah.
He creates them.
It's the
primary expression of deity is in form of relationship.
The family model starts right there. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And he has relationships on his own level. You know, he has infinite
deity
relationship.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, not just the equals.
Yeah.
It's infinite.
That's true.
Well, that's
unlimited.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And it's always existed.
Yeah.
It's eternal.
And eternal.
So all
yes.
of those things, are key points. And if you know, other religions did not make it such a point of central dogma, in other words, that here is a point where we have to reject this concept because, wait a minute, obviously what they mean, it's essentially contempt prior to investigation. Obviously what other people mean is polytheism. If there's three gods, then these are three polytheistic gods with separate origins and everything else. And the Urantia book has this beautiful unity that is presented among the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, that they are three persons in one deity. Well, I heard that growing up in Catholicism my whole life. Three persons in one God. Three persons in one God. Nobody really could fully explain that. Nobody explained exactly how that was, but it was taken as an article of faith. But here in the Urantia book, that article of faith is actually explained. how that could happen. And it's explained by saying, we would time space this idea for you, would be one way to euphemistically paraphrase, and indicate this in terms of sequence relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The first source and center creates the second source and center and the Isle of Paradise. The Isle of, in the presence, the second source of and center and the first source and center jointly propose to trinitize the third source and center in the presence of paradise, and then the cycle of creation is complete. And then they go back and tell us, but this never occurred in time. There is a source relationship, and that source relationship never had a time where there weren't three persons of deity functioning on a level of equality, infinity, eternity, and universality. And that's a tough concept to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
you know, there's
and Marvin brought it up. I'll just put this in quickly.
When you talked about the third paragraph where they say the original and eternal Son is the offspring person of the quote-unquote first completed and infinite thought of the universal Father, again,
exactly,
that's element that you pointed out. Huh, I wonder what they mean by that. Yeah. Good teaching technique, by the way. Suggest a question that you already know the answer to.
I mean, that's
we're
that's
on
exactly,
to you.
that's exactly why it was just so cute to me. It's really lovely the way they do this. In that third paragraph, when they put in quotation marks first, right? Because to us, it's sequential. And so they said, okay, for you guys, we'll use the word first, you know, but we're going to put it in quotation marks. Because actually...
It was the original air quotes.
Yeah.
First.
Exactly.
There you go.
Right. Exactly. Because the original and eternal Son has always been the Son of the Father, and they always have been the co-parents of the infinite Spirit. There wasn't a sequence. And they're just giving that to us as a compromise with human sequential finite understanding. So it's really, really funny almost
linear.
The way they put that first in quotation marks. Yeah.
It's the first.
Right. It's like a whole theological lesson in a single word, you know? It's like it's so elegant.
Yeah. True.
Yeah.
The beauty of it just becomes more and more apparent the deeper you go into it, and the exquisite use of language is unparalleled. I don't think you could find any writing anywhere on the planet more in-depth, more thoughtful, more deliberate than what you find in the Urantia book. I can't even imagine it. But I think, you know, I was talking to my son-in-law just recently. So I had a wonderful 3 weeks with him, and he is a scientist. And I said to him, you know, you understand science. Science is a discipline, and scientists will usually admit that they don't know everything, and they'll revel in the joy of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish religionists would be more like that. I wish religionists would be willing to admit more that they don't know everything, that what they've got is impartial, imperfect, as much as science is willing to admit, well, this is just a theory. You know, scientists can be dogmatic too, no doubt about that. But I wish religionists would be more willing to say, well, you know, we have a piece of the puzzle here. But there's probably more we don't understand.
Right.
Because that would be the opening door, right? That would be the opening door to the question for the universe to answer. If they would just admit.
Exactly.
Like
you're talking about curiosity.
Yeah. And also humility.
Well,
curiosity.
And humility. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
also humility.
I think that's one thing about the Urantia book is it paints a picture of where we are in this whole process that is profoundly humbling. I mean, how much more small can we be than to be embryos who aren't really even spiritually born yet?
we're just being
formed, and we have the entire journey out ahead of us. So how ridiculous, how absurd it is for us to say, well, I understand everything. I know everything. So don't know. You know, we're all so much at the bare beginning of this process that it's profoundly humbling. You know, we're so small. We're so immature.
Yeah. Well,
and that's part of this perspective.
On that very topic, I'm going to say this because I this is always my go-to. Our God is too small. Your God is too small. Or how small is your, how big is your God? In other words, allow the person a chance to grow in their God concept. You know, it goes back to J.B. Phillips, you know, Your God is Too Small, you know, from the early 50s. It was a wonderful little intro book for me, you know, and it's like, because he talked about God in a box, you know, we've got God all boxed in, you know. And so I throw that phrase out all the time, you know, is your God too small? Or is our God too small? Not, you know, I'm not pointing fingers with them, but that phrase has a lot of room for use.
Is your God too human? Would be another way to say
or
it.
Or human? Yeah. There you go.
This idea. Yeah. I love it. This idea of them actually giving us a, you know, humility, I think, is so key and central to the Urantia book. And having that humility or that openness to learn, to decide, gee, you know, there's so much more to know than I can possibly imagine. And the universe now can come in and give you that idea. And there's a quote from paper nine. This is 957. This one to me, this particular quote, like, so totally puts us in our place. And I love it. I come back to it many, many times when I see we're all getting too puffed up about our own opinions. It says, too often, all too often, you mar your minds by insincerity and sear them with unrighteousness. You subject them to animal fear and distort them by useless anxiety. Therefore, though the source of mind is divine, mind as you know it on your world of ascension can hardly become the object of great admiration, much less of adoration or worship. The contemplation of the immature and inactive human intellect should lead only to reactions of humility.
Humility,
inactive. That's
inactive, right? Immature and inactive.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that one. You know, because that they're saying, "Listen up, kids. We've got something to say, and you need to listen now."
Yeah. Wait, there's more.
And then they give you so much more, right? And and it's so worth the effort it takes to understand what they're trying to say. And
well, how do you think how do we activate our minds?
Contemplation, you know, I would think.
I mean, I kind of get what they're saying. It's easy to just go through the day in a daze, you know, without really engaging the mind on anything except just getting through the day.
Right.
And they seem to be talking about maybe more of a philosophical approach to life, or where you think about things, or you plan.
No. I think what they're talking maybe I'm missing your point, Chuck. But I think what the passage that Paula was quoting, for me, what it communicates is our profound immaturity, and that's not a bad thing. What it basically signifies is we are at the barest beginnings, the very earliest manifestation of a maturation journey that is going to carry us into eternity. We hardly even exist spiritually in this realm. We're just being formed embryonically, right? We hardly even function. And yet, for us, it's very sophisticated and it's very satisfying. But what they're saying is you guys are so much at the beginning of this adventure that you don't even realize how ill-formed and immature you are. But that's okay. You know, you have all of eternity to experience it.
And so, I mean, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, part of it for me is the only appropriate reaction when I encounter people who think they know it all is humor. You know, it's like, that's pretty funny.
Humor is good.
The divine anecdote, right? But, go ahead.
Inactive human intellect suggests lack of imagination.
I kind of pair that with their comment about so few real thinkers.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Imagination and creativity
maybe go together.
This word contemplation comes to me always. You know, to contemplate something, to sincerely contemplate the meaning of something, the value of something, the purpose of something. And I think of Jesus in paper 155 on his discourse on religion, the second discourse. He says, this is 155:613, he says, when you once begin to find God in your soul, presently you will begin to discover him in other men's souls and eventually in all the creatures and creations of a mighty universe. But what chance does the Father have to appear as a God of supreme loyalties and divine ideals in the souls of men who give little or no time to the thoughtful contemplation of such eternal realities? While the mind is not the seat of the spiritual nature, it is indeed the gateway thereto. He's saying, give time. Give some time to the thoughtful contemplation of eternal realities. And I think that that quote that I originally said is also about that. You know, you don't think about things. You don't think about things that matter.
You know, the,
you think about nonsense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The passage,
yes.
The passage that Chuck referred to in passing, where so few mortals are real thinkers, it really hooks up with what you're saying, Paula. Because you take a look at what comes immediately after that statement, and I just picked it up. It's 110:7-6. It's in the middle of the paragraph. They say, so few mortals are real thinkers, semicolon. Mm-hmm. So that means what comes next is they're explaining what they mean by that statement. They say, you do not spiritually develop and discipline your minds to the point of favorable liaison with the divine adjusters. The ear of the human mind is almost deaf to the spiritual pleas with the adjuster translates, et cetera, et cetera. The adjuster finds it almost impossible to register. So what they're saying is, what they mean by real thinkers is the development of this faculty of interior communion or connection with the indwelling spirit of God. That's what they mean by a real thinker. It's not an intellectual thing. It's not like you think about these things or you think in this methodology and you become a real thinker. What they mean by real thinking is communion with the indwelling spirit and attuning the inner senses, the inner ear of the mind to the still small voice of the spirit. That's what they mean by becoming a real thinker. So that's really an incredibly powerful statement, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And that all begins with contemplation. I think once again, you know, you're opening the door. You're opening the door to the answer, for the answer to come.
You
know, if you don't ask the right question, if you're not contemplating the right things.
Thomas Keating, it's interesting. The contemplatives, the way they understand it, the way they describe it is, and we're talking Thomas Keating and people like Richard Rohr, who are really a pretty advanced spiritualist, I think. What they're saying is that in the process of contemplative activity, which is essentially worship, what's happening is that God is working inside of us to develop what they called a set of interior faculties, which is a really interesting term. It's almost a set of apparatus for sensing and responding to the still small voice of God, the quiet promptings of the Spirit, and that when we worship regularly, God is growing our sense of faculty, our set of abilities to discern his still quiet leading. So that's what's going on in worship. One part of what's going on in worship is that transformative process.
So going back to the hotline then, we have one, right?
Yeah.
We have a hotline to go.
He's
in.
But it's ill-developed, and God is working to develop it in us, to grow it in us.
True.
Yeah.
Like digging out a channel where it can flow through. And it's a process. We're actively engaged in it. We have to be actively engaged in it. And that starts with desire, with hunger for knowledge, like Chuck said, curiosity. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Hunger and thirst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm reminded of this passage about Jesus in paper 137, you know, and he's trying to figure out how things are going to work out with the apostles. And they say that that night, Jesus did not sleep. Donning his evening wraps, he sat out on the lake shore, thinking, thinking until the dawn of the next day.
Wow.
And then he came to conclusions by the time the sun was coming up. Like, he clearly comprehended, apparently for the first time, that he would never be able to make his followers see him in any other light than as the long-expected Messiah.
Wow.
Along with a couple of other insights born out of that night of thinking. That's kind of interesting how, and they say that Jesus could focus his mind on the problem at hand, his deep thinking mind. Just interesting to think of the power of thought to solve problems, you know, like worshipful problem solving kind of.
Yes.
You know,
so
that's,
it's not that you're detaching from spirit while you're thinking, but you're looking for guidance maybe. But there's work. I mean, thinking is work. I remember my dad used to talk to me about that, you know, because he was a scientist kind of guy, and he had to do a lot of thought work, you know, and he used to tell me, you know, there's not that many people
think through things.
Willing to actually put in the effort to think.
And that is inner work.
Well, you know, what's interesting is you look at, I mean, that came pretty late in his life, right? I mean, it was after the baptism. So he had passed the point where a normal human being would have fused with her thought adjusters, and his thought adjuster was personalized. If I'm right on the timing, Chuck, right? I mean, that was pretty late.
Yeah.
That was toward the end of his life. What you're saying is really profound, that even at that very advanced state, when he was essentially God and man were one being, he still had to spend hours and hours trying to get a sense of what was going on here.
Problem solving.
Yes.
Worshipful prophet.
Yeah.
I like that idea of worshipful problem solving, because you're not just sitting there all by yourself.
What's very interesting about that particular problem is that the problem he was trying to solve was some of what we were referring to, not on the front end. We've referred to some of the problems, you know, the internal problem we have of making assumptions about our own thinking. And we have to watch. By the way, we're getting some feedback.
Pretty solid echo.
Now,
yes,
I was muted, so it's someone else. It's not me. I was muted.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. No blame. Just report. An idea. This struck me when we were reading, because, you know, it really comes down to some of the other issue that we have, and that is, you know, when they say, you know, too many people are not real thinkers, they're also talking about the fact that many people and most people, especially in a complex world, are looking for a shorthand, you know, to be able to deal with reality as they find it. And so some of how they do that is by coming up with stereotypes. And they address this in paper 101, section 7, in the first paragraph, when they say, an idea is only a theoretical plan for action. Okay. While a positive decision is a validated plan of action, one that one would think of as having been thought through, hopefully. Then they go and they say, a stereotype is a plan of action accepted without validation. And to me, I just read into that preconception, prejudice as one species of that stereotype that we're talking about. Very often, in order to get our handle around a problem, we try to take what we know and project it as being the whole thing, instead of really learning what the nature of the problem is. And here's Jesus. I think that's a great example, Chuck, that you brought up with Jesus sitting up all night. What was he trying to solve? He was trying to solve the fact that he could not. There was no way he was going to get around the idea that they're being taught their whole life about a Messiah was not going to, it was going to disallow his ability to function outside of that framework. That's quite a profound realization to say there's no way to psychologically get around this. And we know from his trip to Rome, for all the people he talked to, the Urmia lectures, everything else, he could reason with the reasonable. But here's a species of something that's unreasonable. We find that in our society today, you know, and don't have to talk about any specifics. We're all quite aware of when we encounter someone that has a stereotype and someone that that is proof against the truth, proof against something that is actually a reality. And this is an important thing for all of us to be able to get through. But here's how they go on with that. The materials out of which to build a personal philosophy of religion are derived from both the inner and the environmental experience of the individual, the social status, economic conditions, educational opportunities, moral trends, institutional influences, political developments, racial tendencies, religious teachings of one's time and place, all become factors in the formulation of a personal philosophy of religion. If that's not enough, even the inherent temperament and intellectual bent markedly determine the pattern of religious philosophy. Mm-hmm. Then vocation, marriage, and kindred all influence the evolution of one's personal standards of life, either by how you try to conform or how you push against, you know, those things. So here they've literally given us a template for making determinations about how different, you know, people's philosophies of religion can be. But of course, this can be extrapolated to many other kinds of thinking that people undergo. And then I would just, without reading it, I put it in the chat, but I remind us of those reflective spirits, the significance of origins, which tells us that they too are constantly looking at, in the same way that Jesus was that night that he did not sleep, looking at, you know, the individual race or world, the significance of origin is the paramount question in all our plans for the cosmic advancement of the living creature of the realm. All relationships and the application of ethics grow out of the fundamental facts of origin. Origin is the basis of the relational reaction of the gods. Always does the conjoint actor take note of the man in what manner he was born. And they go on in that wonderful paragraph to indicate how they take that into account in any adjudication and in any formulation, for instance. I mean, I'm sure that's all going to be taken into account when they suggest how we best advance through the mansion worlds and on beyond.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah.
A pint can't hold a quart, right?
That's right.
I mean, they don't.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that, you know, that what came to mind, Andre, in this discussion was the Serenity Prayer, that Jesus was sincerely contemplating a way around a problem, a way to solve a problem that he came to the conclusion, I can't solve this. This is not solvable. This is something that's baked in the cake. And help me accept it. I need to accept it. And in that simple prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's the, you know, the wisdom to know the difference, which the master had. And we don't.
It's interesting how they put that. Going back to that night by the lake, And, you know, whereas Jesus, they say something very similar to what you're just saying, Paul, in the last couple sentences of that same paragraph, where he sort of sums everything up and thinks, well, after all, though he was not the Davidic type of Messiah, he was truly the fulfillment of the prophetic utterances right. of the more spiritually minded of the olden seers. Never again did he wholly deny that he was the Messiah. And this is the kicker. They say he decided to leave the final untangling of this complicated situation to the outworking of the Father's will.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, you know, he sort of figured out what to do next. But,
right.
you know, how many times do we face situations like that, too? You know, it's like, well, if I just figure out what to do next, then,
yeah,
you know, things
he
will
let
work
go
out
and
some,
let
somehow.
God, right?
yeah.
Let go and let God.
Leave the final untangling of this complicated
right.
situation to the outworking of the
right.
Father as well. I mean, that's a faith position, even though.
Oh,
yeah.
And to put a little, you know, even a little more context into it, I mean, this goes back to the beginning of our conversation today when we were talking about how deity, despite the fact that it downsteps to all these different levels, is all in a certain sense one, right? And and so Jesus is struggling with this stuff and comes to clarity and decides to leave certain portions of it to the outworking of the Father's will. and you put that in context of Jesus' statement to the apostles saying, and to his followers, I and the Father are one. You know,
yeah.
that's a profound statement. What Jesus is
mm-hmm.
saying is, even though I'm a human being, I am a deity. I and the Father are of the same deity nature. I'm of the same deity nature as the Father. So you, on one level, while I'm functioning separately, you can't divide me. I'm of the original deity, which is a profound, really remarkable reality when you
yes.
think about it.
And in that reality is the reason that the entire universe of universes works. Those
mm-hmm.
loyal sons of God.
Yeah. Yes.
Do his will because they're
dedication.
Together with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're not separable.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot be separated. They are of one. They are unified. They have real unity, true unity. And the unity is of the concept of the Father's will being the possible outcome in all situations. And there's, you know, if they're loyal to that, and they, for the most part, all are, you only find the disloyalty cropping up, as the Arantia book says, the further away you get from that
mm-hmm.
great central reality, which is God. And then that disloyalty wreaks all kinds of havoc, right?
Mm-hmm.
But,
you know, we can only wonder what it must have been like to be Michael as Michael in that relationship he had with the Father, as opposed to how that shifted once he became human.
Yeah.
What kind of gap, what kind of transition? Because he had to actually make every decision as a human to be one with the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
There was
no operation of the divine mind pre-baptismally to, like, give him a leg up.
Yeah. Right.
He didn't cheat.
Exactly. He,
good point.
Yeah, exactly. He had to learn it, decision by decision. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't it funny how we talk about the eternal Son, and this talk about the sons leads to the Creator Son, and all of a sudden here we are with Jesus, the perfect example of everything they just said.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, it always interests me how we end up with this encapsulated, perfect example that we can
mm-hmm.
point to and say, "See, Jesus did it.
Yeah.
Jesus
yeah.
did it. Yeah,
and he came to my planet.
yeah, he came.
Yeah.
He said yes, he did it. He can do
yeah.
it. He showed
us
the way."
Comments. to that effect in the bestowal instructions, as I recall, something to the effect that, you know, Emmanuel counseling Michael prior to going, leaving for the bestowal. I forget exactly how they put it, but that he was going to have to go through his life depending totally on the Father, depending mm-hmm. totally on the Father's will. And that's what we have to do also. So, like, mm-hmm. no cheating, kind of. You're going to have to do it the same way we have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting because that's, you know, that's
so
how he
poignant.
Becomes the way, the truth, and the life, blazing the trail, whoever they put
Pam
that.
Made the comment that he said, I and the Father are one. And that's ironically what got him killed, right? Who are you to say?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
But he could not, but he was truth. He could not deny that ever, even though that kind of denial would have saved his life. That his material life wasn't as valuable as that one great truth.
Yeah.
And the truth
that
he always
mm-hmm.
held, it's like the book says, he was the truth. He was the truth. And he could not be other than truth. And he told the truth. And it cost him his life. I mean, he's not the only human that's happened to, right? It's happened to all the humans who dared to look at John the Baptist. You know, it's happened all throughout history. Those humans who are courageous enough to tell the truth often get killed for it because the world has not been fond of it. But I think the appetite is growing for it, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, we can think about Navalny in a Putin prison, you know, holding fast to the truth. I mean, there are so many beautiful martyrs today. You know,
right. We call them martyrs, and that's what they are. They're willing to die for the truth, even if it's a truth sacredly held in their own hearts. They're willing to die for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what a great discussion, guys.
Yeah.
Should we go on to the to the last section?
Sure. Let's do it.
Yeah,
go for it, Audrey. Okay, so we are on section 7 of paper 7, the supreme revelation of the Father. The Eternal Son is a complete, exclusive, universal, and final revelation of the spirit and the personality of the universal Father. All knowledge of and information concerning the Father must come from the Eternal Son and his paradise sons. The Eternal Son is from eternity and is holy and without spiritual qualification, one with the Father. In divine personality, they are coordinate. In spiritual nature, they are equal. In divinity, they are identical. The character of God could not possibly be intrinsically improved upon in the person of the Son, for the Divine Father is infinitely perfect. But that character and personality are amplified by divestment of the non-personal and non-spiritual for revelation to creature beings. The first source and center is much more than a personality. But all of the spirit qualities of the Father personality of the first source and center are spiritually present in the absolute personality of the Eternal Son. The primal Son and his sons are engaged in making a universal revelation of the spiritual and personal nature of the Father to all creation. In the central universe, the super universes, the local universes, or on the inhabited planets, paradise Son who reveals the universal Father to men and angels. The Eternal Son and his sons reveal the avenue of creature approach to the universal Father. And even we of high origin understand the Father much more fully as we study the revelation of his character and personality in the Eternal Son and in the sons of the Eternal Son.
The Father comes down to you as a personality only through the divine sons of the eternal Son. And you attain the Father by this same living way. You ascend to the Father by the guidance of this group of divine sons. And this remains true, notwithstanding that your very personality is a direct bestowal of the Universal Father. In all these widespread activities of the far-flung spiritual administration of the Eternal Son, do not forget that the Son is a person, just as truly and actually as the Father is a person. Indeed, to beings of the one-time human order, the Eternal Son will be more easy to approach than the Universal Father. In the progress of the pilgrims of time through the circuits of Avona, you will be competent to attain the Son long before you are prepared to discern the Father.
Wow.
More of the character and merciful nature of the Eternal Son of Mercy you should comprehend as you meditate on the revelation of these divine attributes, which was made in loving service by your own Creator Son, one-time Son of Man on Earth, now the exalted sovereign of your local universe, the Son of Man and the Son of God. Indicted by a divine counselor assigned to formulate this statement depicting the Eternal Son of Paradise.
Beautiful. Thank you, Andre.
Sublime.
Well, thank you.
I love that word indicted, too. That's
yes.
An interesting word.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's indicted. He indicted.
Yeah, there's all these different interpretations of that word.
Right, right.
Wow.
I looked that up once, and I think it said that the process of putting thought into word, which was,
that was the
definition, at least, that I took away, was what they meant by indicted.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Where do you begin with this?
Yeah.
Which one, Chuck? Mm-hmm.
Oh, about our own Creator Son.
Yeah.
There's more of the character and merciful nature of the Eternal Son of Mercy you should comprehend as you meditate on the revelation of these divine attributes, which was made in loving service by your own Creator Son, one time Son of Man on Earth, and now the exalted sovereign of the universe. But I hadn't really thought of that. Thought about, you know, Jesus quite that way before, that he was part of his service was a revelation of the nature of the Eternal Son. I mean, we think of him, you know, in terms of the Father's will and demonstrating a life of communion with the Father.
Mm.
But here they're saying that this was part of his loving service, the loving service by your own Creator Son, which is this revelation of the divine attributes of the Eternal Son. Anyway, that's, I don't know, I just hadn't thought about that before, but that's, I mean, it makes perfect sense if that would be true.
Of course.
And that he might not even call attention to it because he's living it, he's being it, demonstrating it or something like that.
And that Son is a part of the Trinity, a part of the, you know, the one in three.
Sure.
So it's still a revelation of God.
Well, their Eternal Son is his mother, in a sense, you could say.
Yeah, yeah, true.
He's the offspring of the Eternal, of the Father and the Eternal Son.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's related to, it may be related to this statement, which is really an interesting, it really caught me, interesting statement in the second paragraph in the section. The one that begins the character of God. The character of God could not possibly be intrinsically improved upon in the person of the Son, for the Divine Father is infinitely perfect. But then they make this very interesting statement, but that character and personality are amplified.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really interesting term. By divestment of the non-personal and non-spiritual for revelation to creature beings. So what they're saying is that this sun is a more effective communication of the Father's nature because of the fact that the sun is divested of all of the elements of the Father that are non-personal and non-spiritual, because the Father is much more than a person. And the same principle may hold for Jesus' incarnation in the flesh, that because of his leaving behind all of the other deity qualities that he had as a creator son and coming down and being a human being, his personality and character were amplified as so far as they constitute a revelation to us as creature beings.
Yeah.
It reminds me of our friend Errol.
The word amplified is a very interesting word.
Yeah. Or like concentrated.
Errol Strider likes to say, Jesus makes the hand of God small enough to grasp. And I love that. You know,
I love that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask you guys, but then Marvin, you really addressed it in paragraph 2 when you point that out, because what is it about the eternal sun that, and it has to be that it's just more relatable to us. We feel more related to it. We can understand it better. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a son as we are.
Creatures.
He is a son.
We are created. Right.
Well, it's a really interesting principle. And what's interesting about that paragraph and what we're talking about is, or that statement, and what we're talking about is, it holds true on two different levels. The level of the Father creating the eternal Son and the level of our Creator Son, Christ Michael, attenuating his own nature and coming down and manifesting as a human being. In both instances, what they're saying is, for purposes of an effective portrayal to the lower orders, when God attenuates himself and becomes lesser, that expression is much more effective at reaching the beings at the lesser level.
So true.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And isn't that what makes a teacher effective? that
yes.
he's able to understand
yes.
where his students are conceptually
yes.
and tune down his great knowledge to a level where they can understand it,
level
that they
example.
Can grasp.
I got a great example. I was just talking about this to a friend the other day, and I hadn't thought about it for years. It's something I did when I was back in my 20s. I was a graduate student, and one of the things that I had to learn as a graduate student was statistics and how to apply statistics, which was very hard for me because I'm not mathematically oriented by nature, unlike you, Andre, who I envy, who has a natural affinity with numbers and mathematics. But one of the things that then came my way was an opportunity to teach statistics to nurses in a graduate course. There was a group of nurses, and they had to fulfill a requirement to learn a certain amount of statistics to get their degrees, and they hated it. They couldn't deal with it. And so they asked me to teach them the course in statistics, and it's like, yes, you know, if I, as dumb as I am with statistics, if I can get the concept and express it to you, then, and they were so appreciative because I dumbed it down for them in a way that they could understand, because that was the only way I could understand it. So you know, and that simply made it more effective to them. Otherwise, they weren't getting it. And that's what Jesus did for us. He, in a sense, he dumbed God down to the human form. And I don't say that disparagingly. It was a tremendous service. He brought it to the level where we could assimilate it, divinity.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like the way a mother, a robin, partially digests the worm before she gives it to her children, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that they can, her
nice.
Baby chicks, so that they can digest it. They can assimilate it. And it is a service.
Very,
it's a great service.
Very
it
nice.
Takes thought and time. An effort to teach well, to teach effectively, to pass something on, you know? Mm-hmm. And
well,
if you make a mistake, that could be that's a disaster sometimes because you communicate the wrong thing.
Well, and it's hard work. I mean, just what Chuck, the beautiful example Chuck brought up, where he spent all night trying to figure out how to state it and work with it so that it would have the most beneficial impact for his human
mm-hmm.
subjects. You know,
mm-hmm.
he had to really work at it to figure it out. And they say what he did was, in essence, is he went ahead and compromised with the kingdom concept. He really wanted to run with a family concept. And he told them, he said, the people of another age will get it. But in the meantime, we have to go with the kingdom concept.
So true. It's just amazing to think about all that he did for us.
Hmm.
You know, our beautiful descending son.
Hmm. Well, and he's just at the, you know, we're just at the beginning of this age of sovereignty. And
mm-hmm.
here he is. He has full reign now for nearly the last 2,000 years. We're coming up to that 2,000th anniversary in just 6 years and a few months. And from when he, you know, acquired his sovereignty. You think about that and the idea that he had numerous ideas about how he wanted to go forward and what he wanted to do with his bestowal world as well. And we're told that there's an unrevealed, we're marching toward an unrevealed destiny on our world. And I think that unrevealed destiny is not only unrevealed, it's also not completely searchable. It's not really fully comprehensible to us. But you think about the interesting and revealing life that he led on our world, and you begin to realize that there may be something he learned about mortal nature that he wants Urantia to be almost like a signpost or a flagship or a, you know, pick your metaphor. I'm not sure which is the best one, a benchmark, that kind of thing for the mercy of God in advancing mortal survivors. Because after all, there's what's come to mind here for me, I guess at this juncture in my studies has been the idea that here we are on this world, and we're not 50 shades of gray, we're 50,000 shades of gray, you know, where we have so many different ranges of mixtures of good and evil. And of course, it's the intention to do evil that is the biggest problem. But there are so many, I mean, in all of our lives, nobody has led a perfect life on this world. But more importantly, no one has had an origin which would be conducive to making all the right choices if only they could.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wonder, what is it that Michael has chosen to do in perhaps ordering the archangels to have their divisional headquarters here, or allowing them to have their divisional headquarters here. We don't know how that came about exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that they have a lot to do with, they have everything to do with our survival. You know, they're the personality record keepers. All of that that they're involved in is, you know, part and parcel of our progression. And you wonder, the why do that here? And they, you know, indicate, do you have any idea of the significance? And we have to answer no, but we don't know because it's such a it's probably well beyond what we can conceive that they're trying to do here. And we're not there yet. But imagine all of the kinds of history that we have and what is yet to come on our world that will be a standard for what is forgivable, that is going to be a standard for what can still be an evil ground from which good can come.
What is that?
Anyway, that's
exactly. Say, you know, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. Andre, mercy is what comes up for me. And it's like our Michael being not only from a mercy eternal son, he's even a mercy, you know, multiplied version. He's a super mercy being. So what we don't know is just what breadth of experience we have to go through for his mercy to play out. There's a lot of painful days that we are experiencing. I mean, I immediately started thinking about Caligastia and Dalagastia being allowed to remain here and, you know, play with our lives in their own nefarious ways. And it's like, that's all mercy. That's mercy dominated. You know, there is a reason why he did that, why he lets them run free right now. What I hear you saying is that the scope of mercy is unfathomable, and it's painful.
Yeah.
And you know, that's why we hear so much of, why would a loving God do that? You know, why would he allow this happening? I mean, we hear that all the time, and we feel it ourselves. And yet, I can't help but think it's because of that unknown depth of mercy that we have yet to, unravel ourselves. Thank you for bringing that up. That was good stuff.
Well, I found those two paragraphs from the Bestowal Commission, and they kind of address what you guys are talking about, or maybe they amplify what that section we just read in an interesting way. I think, if you don't mind, I could read these.
Paragraphs.
Okay. This is in paper 120, section 1, paragraph 3 and 4. This is Emmanuel.
Hey, by the way, Chuck, we're still getting a lot of echoes and stuff, so we might all want to mute unless we're speaking.
Okay. Yeah, I've been muting.
Okay.
Anyway, seems like it's not so bad right at the moment. Anyway, so Emmanuel says to Michael, his paradise brother, speaking to him, says, in entering upon the Arantia Bestowal, you have voluntarily divested yourself of all extraplanetary support and special assistance, such as might be rendered by any creature of your own creation. As your created sons of Nevadon are wholly, referring to us and others, are wholly dependent upon you for safe conduct throughout their universe careers, so now must you become wholly and unreservedly dependent upon your Paradise Father for safe conduct throughout the unrevealed vicissitudes of your ensuing mortal career. I mean, isn't that an apt description of what you were just saying, Pam? You know, the unrevealed vicissitudes of your ensuing mortal career. And when you so have finished this bestowal experience, you will know in very truth the meaning and the rich significance of that faith trust which you so unvaryingly require of all your creatures to master as a part of their intimate relationship with you, as their local universe creator and father. Throughout your Arantia Bestowal, you need to be concerned with but one thing, the unbroken communion between you and your Paradise Father. And it will be by the perfection of such a relationship that the world of your bestowal even all the universe of your creation will behold a new and more understandable revelation of your Father and my Father, the universal Father of all. Your concern, therefore, has only to do with your personal life on your rancho. I will be fully and efficiently responsible for the security and unbroken administration of your universe from the moment of your voluntary relinquishment of authority until you return to us as universe sovereign, confirmed by paradise, and received back from my hands, not the vicegerent authority which you now surrender to me, but instead the supreme power over and jurisdiction of your universe. So the pairing of those two things, you know, this achieving this supremacy of, authority in the universe means it has to go all the way down to our level and face the vicissitudes that we have to face. And, you know, fascinating how that's all, you know, the one is the requirement for the other. But it's no different, in a sense, from what we have to go through. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
part
that's
about,
what I say.
Yeah. Well, just one last thing. The thing about
interesting point.
A new and more understandable revelation. I thought that tied in pretty well with what you guys were talking about a few minutes ago. You know, downstepping, making things more understandable.
Seems to me that's always the task, right? How do we make it more understandable?
Mm-hmm.
It's the task with our revelation here. It's the task with just presenting the gospel.
Yeah.
It's the task with getting people. I mean, goodness gracious, think about the task we have in trying to get people past their dogma and doctrine to understanding that it's an invisible brotherhood of which we are all a part, you know, and invisible siblinghood, if you prefer, you know, where all the brothers and sisters are related to each other, and it's not something you have to earn. It's something that's there because of the love of God, the love and mercy of God, and it's just right there.
It brings us all together.
Mm-hmm.
And we and that is a powerful message, and it's a message that much of the world is not yet willing to hear.
Yeah, then what is that about?
it's about selfishness, really. In the final analysis, it's about selfishly holding on to something we think we're going to lose if we relinquish it.
Right.
But if we follow the teachings of Jesus, if we give it away, it'll come back to us. We don't ever have to worry about losing it. But only by giving it away can we have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can we truly have it? And meaning all of us have it. And I love, you know, I was thinking one day about how Jesus belongs to God and we belong to Jesus, but we also belong to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We belong to each other. And that is our brotherhood right there. We belong to each other. We are responsible for each other. It's up to us to care that they don't have enough. They don't have enough to subsist and have a modicum of decency in life. It's not up to God. God already made that decision. They don't have enough. When are you kids going to give that to them? When are you going to share what you have with your brother so that he also can have a good life? When are you going to give a little so that others can also enjoy the satisfactions of living? It really ultimately comes down to, you know, rebellion being unbridled self-liberty and unmitigated selfishness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is up to us to be as loving as they are, as willing to give all good things as they are, so that all can enjoy the bounty of the universe of the universes, the bounty of the love of God. We have to manifest it. You know, that's the lesson. And if we can do that, we will shine out as a beacon of the universe. We will be unprecedented. We will show what can be surmounted, what it's possible for God within humans to do. And that will be great. And I have faith that we'll get there. I do.
Yes, we want to make it as tasty as possible, you know. And I love the old adage, you know, taste and see that the Lord is good. I've always loved that. And in fact, it's a great sign for your kitchen, you know, right above the stove, you know. But yeah, it's like, make it tasty, savoring, you know.
Attractive, and beautiful.
Attractive, all of that good stuff,
Right. That's our job. That's what we get to do. And what a wonderful job we have. It's not easy, though. It's like Jesus agonizing over, you know, how am I ever going to get past this Messiah thing, you know? But I remember years ago someone telling me, you know, don't quibble when someone asks you if Jesus is your Savior. You can say unequivocally, yes, he is. He absolutely is.
Yes.
You know, it's not about saving me from God, though. It's about saving me from me.
For God.
For God, right. Not from God, but for God. And from myself, from my own base tendencies, you know, from my own humanness.
We have a question on the board. Arzakian wants to know if there's a way to listen to these shows, the archives, while driving.
They're on various podcasts.
People do.
Go ahead, Andre.
All you have to do is click on the archive online, go to the web, you know, blogtalkradio.com/cosmiccitizen, and then pick out the show that you want. They're all arranged in order from most recent to oldest shows. There's, goodness, close to 15 years of shows there. And if you're interested in this show, this will have downloaded or uploaded rather, and processed probably within 20 to 30 minutes after the show concludes in the next 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. I hope that helps. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, you can. And you can go also while you're on your PC or whatever, you can go and download any episode and then listen to it later. So you could download it onto your phone or however you want to access it and then listen to it in your truck or in your car or where. You know, we've heard from truck drivers who like to listen as they're traveling across the country. It's nice.
It's a little clunky searching for stuff. For the older stuff, but it's still, there's a good archive there and it's all there available for you to listen to.
Yeah.
And Paula is the golden thread through all of it. So she's been on since the beginning.
Yes, the golden thread.
I'm just addicted to it.
Yeah.
I think we have your new title, Paula, the golden thread.
There you go.
I love it.
I'm just addicted to you guys. I'm addicted to our Saturday.
Addicted to love. You're addicted to love, God.
I'm addicted to love. There you go. And you guys manifested abundantly, and I'm so appreciative of your wisdom, your scholarship. Oh my gosh, I often say I feel like the frog who kissed the prince. You know,
back at you. And back at you. I'm just proud to be associated with, you know, people that have studied so deeply, and it's really, we're a lovely cohort together, and I really enjoy the camaraderie and the fact that we all really take this so seriously and lightly at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, and I love is just the different minds and how each of us is really comes from a unique vantage point to the revelation. And that makes it so rich, really.
Yes. It does. And there's a, and we're pretty diverse. So, but thank you, listeners. Just allow me to say, we love you.
Yes.
We get, you know, when you come and join us on the board, we love that. And when you listen to the
yes.
show and tell us you like it, we love that too. And we love doing
Absolutely.
It. So thank you.
Yeah.
Are we on to paper eight next time?
Yes. We are.
We
on to
we
the infinite spirit.
Do.
Oh, let's
might as well. Finish out the Trinity, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Yeah.
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 Awesome.
Yeah,
Andre,
yeah,
you
great.
Might put a little note or Pam on the board about that while people are still there, because we're off the air now. But
yes,
reading,
we
thanks
are.
You guys. It was so glad.
Although
to
they,
be, so good
some
to
people
be back.
Can hear us if they're tuned in. Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, right. If they're listening.
Yeah.
So thanks.
All right.
All right.
It was wonderful.
Well,
have a great week,
indeed.
Everyone. See you next week.
Okay.
You too.
Looking forward to
next week.
All right.
Bye
love
for
you.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Love you. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.